Hello, and you're very welcome to episode 27 of The Fifth Court, a podcast on legal affairs presented by myself, Peter Leonard Barrister.
Myself, Mark Tupman, barrister and editor of Decisis.ie.
Mark, good to see you as always. And wasn't it wonderful, the reaction we got during the week? People were delighted we were back again.
Yeah.
I think they were all worried that we were
going
to throw our hat at it and give it up. So, no, we're delighted to be back. And all the good wishes we got during the week, we are thrilled with. So thank you very much to everybody. Well, last week, Mark, as you will recall, we talked to Associate Professor of Law in Maynooth, Brian Flanagan. What was that about again?
Oh, it was something to do with judges and the internet.
So what was the reaction to that? As we know, Brian and his colleagues, who are based on the East Coast of America, found that Wikipedia had featured in some High Court decision-making. The High Court judges are having none of it. And it was an interview that really got people excited. Well, today we are metaphorically off on our travels in that we have an international guest, albeit coming into us in the studio. Regular listeners will know that among the legal books that have been recommended to us on this show was the biography of legendary British libel lawyer George Carman, written by his son Dominic Carman, entitled No Ordinary Man. Well, Dominic, though a journalist rather than a lawyer, specialises on legal matters and is in Dublin currently, where he is dealing with all the big firms and he's writing a report on international legal development. And he's going to come in to us and talk to us about that. And I'm going to have to put a few questions to him about his old man as well, the legendary libel lawyer and criminal defence lawyer as well, George Carman. Mark, are you looking forward to that?
Absolutely. I watched the Hugh Grant the dramatisation of the Jeremy Thorpe trial. And he played a big part in that.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But first, we're going to deal with some cases from the Decisis website that you have very kindly identified. And the first one is a very interesting ruling on the availability of civil legal aid and whether it is available to corporate bodies. This is the case of Friends of the Irish Environment, CLG, and the Legal Aid Board, a Court of Appeal decision of Mr. Justice Murray.
Yeah, so this is obviously a case by a charity. I mean, it's company limited by guarantee, but Friends of the Irish Environment are obviously a body that concern themselves with protecting the environment. And as we've discussed previously on the show, the Aarhus Convention is now in place, which is designed to protect people from unduly prohibitive having to pay too much in legal fees in relation to any challenges relating to the environment. And so not unreasonably or not unsurprisingly, I suppose, the Friends of the Irish Environment have took the view that they should be entitled to legal aid in relation to civil actions. Now, legal aid is obviously very widely used on the criminal side and in the family courts, not so much used in day-to-day civil actions, although it's open to people to apply for it. However, the legislation concerning legal aid limits it to natural persons, and so it is not available to bodies corporate.
Yes,
and so in the High Court, and then the Court of Appeal, it was affirmed that it is
so
not
a strong
available.
Decision in that regard.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Next to a judicial review decision concerning a child with autism spectrum disorder. This is the case of NT versus HSE, a High Court decision of Ms. Justice Siobhan Phelan. The HSE in this case had concluded following a review that the child did not sufficiently meet the criteria for disability. However, on review, Ms. Justice Siobhan Phelan found that a comprehensive assessment had been carried out. Everything had been considered.
Yeah. So, but the background was that this is a child on the autism spectrum disorder. As we know, the nature of the spectrum is such that you can be very severely disabled with autism, and there are some people who I think the term is high functioning, and I don't know if that's the correct term medically. But so this was a child who had been considered to suffer from a disability. There was then a review by the HSE, and the HSE found that notwithstanding that the child was on the spectrum, that the child was no longer considered to suffer from a disability. Now, obviously, that has implications for the family for a number of different things. And the family challenged that decision, saying that they felt that the child did qualify as suffering from a disability. But in the judicial review, Ms. Justice Siobhan Phelan looked at considered all of the circumstances of the case and came to the conclusion that the HSE had considered all the relevant material. And so there was
and
no
they
basis.
They are the party who are entitled
exactly,
to make
that,
a decision.
That is the job of the HSE.
Yes.
And if they considered all the relevant material,
did everything
then
they should have done.
Exactly.
Absolutely. No, very good.
Yeah.
Good decision in relation to that. Finally, to a work-related personal injuries claim. This was the case of Curley versus Summerhill Construction Company Limited. This is a decision of Mr. Justice Sanfi. This case concerned a subcontractor who suffered serious injuries when he fell from a counter while painting a ceiling. Now, the court did find negligence on the part of the contractor who was in control of the site, but also found contributory negligence on the part of the subcontractor who'd got up on the counter.
Yeah, so yeah, exactly. I mean, this is a case where, I mean, as you know, in any case concerning employment, what the court generally looks at is not necessarily the individual negligence, but whether there was a safe system of work. And so if you're asking somebody to paint a ceiling, you need to make sure that what they're standing on is a safe thing to stand on. And whether that's a platform, whether it's a ladder, in this case, he stood on a plastic counter, which was not designed to support a person. He fell. He obviously suffered very severe injuries because the injuries, I think, were assessed at 159,000. But they also found that he himself was responsible to the extent of 40%, which is
40%,
pretty serious.
Yes.
And so it was reduced down to 95,000.
Okay, very interesting decision there. Okay, back shortly with Dominic Carman.
Silence in the Fifth Court.
Okay, it is my great pleasure to welcome to the studio Dominic Carman. Now, Dominic, you are a journalist as opposed to officially a lawyer, but you are somebody who writes about legal affairs all the time, and you also have a very strong pedigree, family pedigree in the law. You're the son of the late George Carman QC, who is probably the best-known personality in British jurisprudence as an advocate in the second half of the 20th century. So we might have a little chat, and you wrote a book about your dad. So we'll have a chat about that as well. But you've been in Ireland, and what you do is you write reports about the international legal system and how legal systems merge, etc., etc.
The business
of
law
stuff.
And international law firms.
Okay, will you tell
markets.
Us a little bit what
yeah,
has
sure.
you in Ireland at the moment?
So I've been interviewing for the umpteenth time, but the first time face-to-face, the major law firms in Dublin, the Big Six, together with the largest offshore firms here, Maples, Walkers, Ogier, Le Mans, and then what we might call the large-scale international disruptors, the DLA Pipers, Dentons, and so on, Pinsent Mason, Sims & Simmons. There's a long catalogue of international firms who now have a presence here. And the battle for talent, which is obviously playing out between them as they all look for to recruit the best lawyers in what is a difficult market for them to do so because there's a finite supply. And at the same time, meeting the demands of their international clients, which are significant. And Dublin is a very important legal centre and will become even more so over time.
Is this all post-Brexit?
It's partly post-Brexit, but I think that was an accelerator rather than a catalyst of a trend that was already in play. So international firms started to open up here in for the global financial crisis, 2006 to 2009. There was then a hiatus, obviously, with the global financial crisis and Ireland's problems in the early part, 10 to 12 years ago. But then post-Brexit, post the referendum result, yes, there's been a further steady stream of international firms opening up, some of which have significant ambitions in terms of size, scale and scope in terms of what they're doing, servicing their international network of clients, and of course, taking on the local market.
Yes, and we are known as the land of 100,000 welcomes. Are the existing Big Five, Big Six, Big Seven, Big Eight, I mean, there's other firms that would like to be thought of in those
of course.
Sort of terms, are they with open arms welcoming all this international competition into the Irish market?
I think the public message is very much that they do welcome the international competition because it internationalises Dublin as a legal centre. Competition is always a good thing. The ecosystem of law firms in Dublin is only going to be enhanced and developed as a consequence of that increased internationalisation and the development of talent. However, and there is a however, if one looks at the corollary over time and what has happened in other comparable markets where you've had large internationalization, not least London, but Paris and Frankfurt particularly, is that as disruptors, some of those firms ultimately merge with, take over, or cause the fragmentation of the existing status quo. So in asking the questions I have of a number of managing partners of different firms, take the big six now, will they still all be operating in the same basis in 10 years' time? And they all say, no, some of them won't be. They will have merged, they will have changed, they will have become part of an international network. Which firms and when and in what time scale is not difficult, you know, it's not possible to predict. But the Dublin legal landscape will change further. It's work in progress.
But am I hearing you correctly, Dominic, when you say, as a kind of a first principle, the general position is that this rising tide will lift all boats? Is that the attitude at the moment?
Yes, but when you have any disruptors entering a market, then there are inevitably, over time, some casualties and some changes of name, some changes of label. And that is what will happen. It's just a question of which firms will merge, which will become part of an international network, and which may merge with each other. That's all impossible to predict. But that's very much what happened in the French market and the German market, which are much more substantial, but happened longer ago when the UK and the US international firms entered those markets and started hiring and growing aggressively. So you take France now, there are two or three domestic firms and about 40 international firms that dominate the French market. Germany is slightly different. There are still quite a large number of successful independents. But in aggregate, if you take the top 20 law firms in Germany, there are more working for international firms based in the US or the UK than there are based in Germany.
Can I ask you, who are the clients of the big international firms? I mean, when a large international firm opens up in Ireland, I mean, are they effectively advising multinational firms that want to have a presence in Ireland because of, whether it's because of our tax status, whether it's because we're now in the main English-speaking country in the EU? Is it that kind of client? We hear a lot about, for example, the aviation industry having sort of effectively, yes, the Irish effectively dominate the aviation leasing industry in that, obviously. Correct. Is it that kind of business, or who are the clients?
It varies from firm to firm is the answer. But many of them come here to service international clients who are being served by Irish domestic firms, and also to provide an international network for companies looking to relocate, reallocate resources to Ireland. And in a post-Brexit environment, you know, the greater movement of staff has been evident from some of the banks, some of the PE houses. But at the same time, they're also looking at work on behalf of corporates. They're looking on behalf work on behalf of regulators and on behalf of all types of international institution. And in some cases, they're looking at very much a sectoral approach or a specialist approach. So a firm like Deckert, for example, does almost primarily investment funds and nothing else. Bird and Bird, which opened recently, which is a very large UK international firm with an IP, IT, healthcare specialization in Ireland. That's what they're going to do. And they're not going to do the mainstream corporate M&A work. That's their USP, and that's what they're going to remain doing. And they have a very large international network of offices that's to service.
And so, for example, the funds industry are funds based in Ireland but servicing a sort of international investor community.
Yes, and the funds industry, from all objective commentators, is only going to grow much further. I mean, you have the competition with Luxembourg. Those are the two major fund centres in Europe, with London completing the triangle. But the funds, in terms of the source of funds outside Europe, is primarily from the United States. And clearly, as that grows and continues to grow further, then there's work for funds lawyers.
Well, Dominic, I'm sure there's a lot of people here in Dublin that will be very interested in reading that report. Is it due out soon?
It is. It will be published in a few weeks. It's available on reportslegal.com. Nice,
okay,
and straightforward.
Yeah, great. Well, I'm sure, as I said, people would read avidly that interest, and the knowledge of the international market that you bring to it, I'm sure will be of huge interest to Irish-based firms and these firms who are now coming into Ireland.
Yes.
I mentioned at the start of our interview here about your family connection with the law. You yourself stayed a journalist. I know you ran for Parliament on a couple of occasions, etc. We don't have to go into that. But you stayed as a journalist. You didn't become a barrister like your dad.
No, I never wanted to. I didn't know what I wanted to be when I was younger. I still don't. You know, it's one of those things. You become a journalist by default. I started a career in banking, which was interesting, but I realized it wasn't for me. I spent more time writing for the in-house bank newspaper than I was doing the job, which sort of says something. I went away for the Times newspaper, and I ended up at Euromoney Publications working for a great Irishman, in fact, Porrick Fallon, whose brother Ivan Fallon was business writer of the Sunday Times, and his father was an Irish poet called also Porrick Fallon. And he was one of the best financial journalists in London, and a tremendously inspirational figure from whom I learned a great deal.
And there's an Irish strand in your own family, isn't there?
There is.
That's it. We're going to get on to your dad, if you don't mind, because, you know,
sure.
We as train spotter lawyers want to have a chat about him as well, if you know. I'm just curious, the desire not to follow a legal path, was that a conscious decision? As you say, you know, we all fell into journalism. I was previously a journalist myself, and that is, I agree with you, that you can fall into journalism. But was it just, you know, your father was such a huge personality in the legal world that you wanted to do something different?
I don't think it was so much that. I think it was more that the law didn't inherently interest me as a teenager. Why would it? Why should it? I don't think it does most teenagers. And I think most young lawyers aren't necessarily inherently interested in the law. They're interested in the legal career and the opportunities it can supply. And my son actually read law at UCL, and he decided it was an incredibly boring degree and he wished he hadn't read it. He then became a practicing lawyer. But, you know, he wished he'd read something else.
Yes.
Jonathan Sumption, famous law lord, and Britain's best-known QC, commercial QC until recently, also said that lawyers should never read law. He read history, which is a great advocate.
So it's more a vocational qualification on top of...
I think the argument is you need to be a little more mature.
The liberal arts degree sort of thing.
Yeah, you need to be a little more intellectually mature and emotionally mature to understand what being a lawyer is. You know,
well, we've had guests in here who have done PhDs in maths physics and then became lawyers.
Exactly.
So there are many routes on the same journey. Okay, can I talk to you about your father, who sadly passed away in 2001? I know you wrote a book then the following year.
I did.
No Ordinary Man, and that was the title you put on it, A Life of George Carman,
yes.
QC. Now, I know there was a challenging relationship there. We don't really want to get into that. We're more interested in the man as a lawyer.
Yes.
He was, to set out the Irish connection, he was of Irish parentage. His mother was from County Waterford, am I right?
My grandmother, who sadly I never met, she died in 1954 at the age of 49. She was from Dungarvan, and her brother was Christy Moylan, who was a member of the Dungarvan successful, I understand, team that won the All-Ireland Hurling Championship in 1940.
Yes,
six, seven.
Wow.
I probably got that wrong, but there or thereabouts. And he has quite a substantial Wikipedia page, which I've read with interest, and I've read about him. He died in 1996, and I never met him, sadly.
Okay, but your father, his mother, I think, was the prime mover behind your father getting educated, Catholic schools, all of that sort of stuff.
Correct. Yeah, Irish Christian Brothers education in Blackpool, then went to Up Holland Seminary, not far from there. At which point, at some point in his late teens, he decided that he didn't want to be a priest and instead wanted to study law. I don't know if there's a defining moment, whether it was a gradual evolution, but clearly by the time he was 18, he no longer wanted to be a priest and instead had this vision in life that he wanted very much to be an advocate, to be a barrister. And I think he'd read some of the biographies and autobiographies of famous barristers and been tremendously inspired by that. And also he discovered a natural talent for debating. So the synthesis of his skills, and he was very much a tremendous facility with words, facility with language.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And he initially practiced in the north of England. And
Correct. The
guy that we know today and the man who made all the headlines and became the celebrated criminal and then libel lawyer that he was, that was a slightly later stage in his life. He wasn't an overnight sensation. He was about 50 when, I think, the big case, Jeremy Thorpe, wasn't that it? Jeremy Thorpe was the case that made his career.
That's right. I mean, he spent 25 years on the Northern Circuit from 1953-54 to 1979, doing general common law, specialising in personal injury work, doing some criminal work, but not a huge amount. And he was talent spotted by Sir David Napley, who was then probably the best known criminal solicitor in London, in 1973, when he defended the manager of the Battersea Fund Fair, which sadly resulted in the collapse of one of the carts and killing five children in May 1972. And he managed to get the manager of the fund fair acquitted of manslaughter. And Napoli watched him, watched his speech to the jury, watching cross-examining witnesses, and thought, I really ought to be using this,
this
man.
This is the guy. This is the man.
But it took, there was a long fuse because it was 5 years before Jeremy Thorpe was charged.
Okay, so listen to that, all you lawyers out
August 1978. It wasn't an overnight.
It doesn't happen overnight.
Rather frustrated, having been promised work by Napoli, that it didn't materialise, and then suddenly it did in a rather big way.
Yeah. God, he must have met some of the solicitors I know. But anyway, can I ask you about the Jeremy Thorpe case, though?
Yes.
1979, this is huge. Will you explain to our Irish listeners? I mean, obviously people will generally have heard of Jeremy Thorpe, former Liberal Party leader, had a relationship with a man who he was deemed to have conspired to have killed. And your father stepped into the breach and defended him.
Yes. He, together with three other co-defendants, were charged with conspiracy to murder, and Jeremy Thorpe alone was charged with incitement to murder in addition. The prosecution case was strong. But so was the defence case, because the two chief prosecution witnesses upon whom the prosecution primarily resided in terms of the strength of their case, one was Norman Scott himself, who was the man who was alleged to have been targeted for assassination by a rather inept man called Andrew Gino Newton, who took him out on the moor at night and tried to shoot him and the gun jammed.
Shot his dog, I
shot his dog called Rinker first and then turned it on him and he ran away and survived, the gun jammed. And a man called Peter Bessel, who had been a fellow Liberal MP in the 1960s with Jeremy Thorpe and had fled to California. And he, it emerged during questioning, had a W money contract with the Telegraph, whereby if, after giving evidence, Thorpe was convicted, he would get £50,000, and if he was acquitted, he'd only get £25,000, which, of course, rather prejudiced the credibility of his evidence, given the fact there was every incentive for him to try and nail Thorpe in every way possible in the witness box. But on 3 days of cross-examination, both by my father and by John Matthew, he somewhat dissolved and gave up the cause and confessed to all sorts of things in his own. I mean, he was a man of a weak moral character, I think he was described as. He had all sorts of problems in terms of money, in terms of women, in terms of use of drugs, and he confessed to it all. And sort of gave up the ghost.
It is an interesting case, isn't it, where the where it wasn't just the jury that was persuaded by your father. The judge was remarkably sympathetic to the defence case, and not only gave a very sympathetic charge to the jury, but there's a very famous Peter Cook sketch based on that.
There is.
That charge to the jury, which from, I think, The Secret Policeman's Ball, which is, I have to say, I turn to every couple of months because it's just of such entertaining value.
It's wonderful, inspirational, comedic. Peter Cook at his best. It is, of course, a caricature of what actually happened. And whilst the judge did certainly demonstrate his prejudices and very nakedly demonstrated what he thought of the witnesses concerned, and some of the language used in Peter Cook's parody is not so far removed from the actual truth. It does completely neglect the fact that he also did fearfully and fearlessly put the prosecution case in the strongest terms. And then, so having done that, he then, particularly actually Norman Scott, whom he clearly did not like, but sometimes biased summings up from judges can rebound.
Of course,
yeah. And the idea that the reason I'm sort of hesitating is because several jurors were interviewed afterwards, including by Sir David Napoli, who spoke to them, you know, what moved you, what made an impact on you? And it wasn't the summing up. It was actually the evidence and the cross-examination, and they weren't all of one mind, and they spent a lot of time deliberating, nearly 3 days. So it wasn't an open and shut case, and it, by no means did they think, when they concluded the defence case, that they'd won it. Far, far from it. There are other issues in terms of the money, which was much more compelling.
Can I move you on as well? I mean, obviously, so that was your father was initially a criminal. Not at all. It's wonderful. This is wonderful, Dominic. I'm really enjoying it. Actually getting lost in what you're saying, actually. Yes. And not tuning into the fact that I needed to ask another question. But your father was so initially made his mark as a criminal barrister, but then we know him later as a man who went into the area of defamation.
So 10 years at the top as a criminal barrister and then 10 years at the top as a libel lawyer.
Yes. Okay. So in terms of other criminal cases, I know there was a case in terms of a doctor, a Harley Street doctor, who he defended.
He was a doctor at Leicester, a Royal Infirmary, actually called Dr. Leonard Arthur, who was a paediatrician, who was charged with the murder in October 1981 of a Down syndrome baby. And he was acquitted. And the jury took only 10 minutes in his case to acquit him.
Okay.
Which shows the strength of opinion that jury has, yes, about the prosecution, okay, case that was brought. Yeah.
So let's go to the libel cases. What was the first big libel case?
The first one that really moved minds and made an impact on defamation lawyers in London and indeed in newspapers was that of Sonia Sutcliffe, the wife of the Yorkshire Ripper. Because she had successfully brought a number of cases, not least against Private Eye and several other newspapers for defamation. The sting of the libels, various libels, but essentially being that she had known what was going on, that she'd failed to report it to the police, and in one case that she'd since Peter Sutcliffe had gone to prison, another man who looked remarkably like Peter Sutcliffe as her new partner. And all the newspapers settled, and the News of the World decided to fight it. And I watched in court as my father cross-examined Sonia Sutcliffe, and I must say it was the most chilling episode because in several hours of cross-examination, she started to talk about the victims of the Yorkshire Ripper. And she essentially said it was a misnomer to say that he was a ripper because he didn't actually rip his victims, he stabbed them.
And that came out in the course of cross-examination?
It came out in the course of cross-examination.
And obviously that was very damning in front of the jury.
Well, the semantic difference is irrelevant. The chill in the courtroom, yes, as she was describing it, as if she was describing, you know, cutting up a piece of meat on a slab, was really quite horrific, actually.
And to go back to the technique of, you know, cross-examination that your father was renowned for.
Yes.
That was it. He put in a long time in terms of cross-examination. He was very methodical in the way he went about it. He was a great man for the one-liner. He'd always, and he'd look at the jury, he'd lock his eyes on one juror in particular. There was a sense of theatricality about him, but it was that persistent cross-examination that resulted in a breakdown of people, you know, in the witness box, which ultimately proved successful.
Not always, but sometimes, yes. When he was asked about cross-examining Arthur Scargill, he went to speak to Robin Day, Sir Robin Day, who used to chair Question Time in the UK, because he questioned Scargill many times. And the one thing he came away with, of course, is the fact that on Question Time, or indeed any political questioning, he was limited by time. It's 10 minutes, half an hour at the very most. But of course, in the witness box, there's no limit of time. And he made that point very clear to Arthur Scargill. And I think he questioned
him
three or four days, yes. And that was unusual. Clearly, three or four days is not that common. But effectively, the point is that there isn't, because there's no time limitation, it's a war of attrition. And quite often, I'm not a cross-examiner, not a barrister, but there are various, obviously, methods by which you can dissect a witness or get a witness in that revelatory moment where they suddenly agree they've lied or confess to something. That actually rarely happens, but what does happen instead during that war of attrition, and what my father's particularly adept at doing, is chipping away at the edifice of credibility.
Yes.
And sometimes surprising a witness and sometimes taking a risk. And there's a barrister's rule that you should never ask a question to which you don't know or have a pretty good idea of what the answer is going to be because it's too damn risky.
But he didn't believe in that.
Well, he generally did. But an example of one case where he didn't was involved David Miller, who was...
The Chelsea shirt. Is that it?
It was related to the Chelsea shirt. Okay, it was a woman called Mona Bowens, who was the daughter of PLO. And she had taken on David Miller on holiday. And this was tangentially irrelevant. And my father asked, who paid for the holiday, not knowing what the answer was going to be. And she said, I did. And that moment, that's when David Miller had to resign. He didn't resign immediately, but he resigned immediately after the case because, of course, he shouldn't be receiving free holidays from the daughter of a PLO official.
And Could I say also, your father, he wasn't averse to, you talked about your ancestor or your great uncle who was a hurling star for the Dacia, for County Waterford. Well, he wasn't averse to a bit of ground hurling, as we call it over here, where he'd strike a few low blows if he needed to do that. He was well able to bring in sort of a piece of evidence late in the day that could be a game changer. Didn't that happen specifically in the case of, was it Gianni Allen, who he was acting for Channel 4, the accusation that she had a relationship with Eugene Terriblanche. Wasn't that the issue?
Yes. And a diary arrived in the courtroom in a brown paper envelope and was handed down the line to the solicitor, then to the junior counsel, then to my father, with some sort of explanatory note as to what it was, and then asked for an adjournment. And that, of course, then was had to be admitted as evidence, the judge admitted as evidence, and then she was questioned on it for a day or two. And it completely destroyed her case because it included references to her fantasies about Terriblanche and various other aspects to the case that completely destroyed her credibility.
But he knew that package was going to come into court, did he not?
No, he didn't. Okay. No. Another example, you mentioned Gillian Telfall. So yes. A video emerged, and that came to the possession of News International lawyers over the weekend, for which they paid a sum to two young lads from who had filmed Gillian Telfall at the Anna Scher School Theatre, pretty much simulating on camera what she was alleged to have done and lay by in the A1.
You don't need to go any further.
intimate with her.
Look it up on Google, folks.
With her partner, yeah. And unfortunately for her, it was there on video and with her making jokes about it in daylight in a very crude way.
You obviously sat in court and watched a number of your father's cases.
Yes, he liked me to, when I could, attend. Mm.
Yeah. And not in any kind of professional capacity, just as a
second ear, and also to, I mean, I did help him with some speech, some phrases, some speeches. And that started really with Thorpe. Mm. And the only phrase I can think that made any, which he did actually use in Thorpe, was the 12 most precious votes of all, which I had said, well, you know, this man's used to getting lots of votes from the public and that's been his lifeblood. I said, no, these are the 12 votes that matter most of all. He said, love it.
And that was the line.
And he used that, yes. Yes. There are lots of lines he didn't use. But the case I spent the longest was that of Ken Dodd.
Yes.
I was on actually 3 weeks.
Can I give my line from that one?
Please.
He said that accountants are sometimes comedians, but comedians are never accountants.
Indeed, that wasn't original. He'd heard it in some form at an after-dinner speech. Where he gave an afternoon speech at an accountant's dinner and somebody else said something about accountants. So he adapted that. He was a great believer. I mean, of David Meller, he said, he's like an ostrich burying his head in the sand, thereby exposing his thinking parts. That derived from a joke made in the Oxford Union in 1951. So he remained, you know, he retained these one-liners in his mind and adapted or amended them according to circumstance.
And were you involved with him as he sort of prepared his cross-examination? I mean, did you see his sort of work methods and how he kind of dissected a case in order to prepare for these?
He was both highly prepared and highly unprepared. The spontaneity of cross-examination he regarded as very important, and be able to think on your feet and go from question A to the next subordinate question, and if necessary, deviate. Is critical, whereas if you've got everything written out, it can be too formulaic and not necessarily adapt to the circumstance. So he was both.
And we've talked about him acting for, obviously, media organisations and newspapers, and we know that when there was a libel case, straight to the phones, get him before the other side get him. That's the comment that was put out there, whether that's true or not.
Alan Rusbridge, editor of The Guardian, allegedly said that in the context of Aitken, when Aitken sued The Guardian, and he said, let's get George Carmen before he does.
He acted for the punter as well. I mean, for example, Elton John, wasn't that a famous case where he defended him?
Well, it was famous in the sense, because it was Elton John, it was famous. The issue was interesting. It was a mistaken identity where the journalist had seen somebody he thought was Elton John drinking, throwing up, whatever, and it wasn't Elton John, and they couldn't prove it was Elton John, and the newspaper should have settled, but didn't. And my father, again, used a phrase that he'd heard, I think used originally in the Liberace case in the 1950s, which was asking the jury to award a sum that would wipe a smile off the board of directors of Mirror Group newspapers.
Okay, so
they duly did.
So the jury were receptive to that. Final question in relation to his cases. This has been really fascinating, yes. Dominic. Jonathan Aiken was the last case. What was one of the last cases that he
probably
acted in?
The last, really last high profile case was for Mohammed Al-Fayed.
Oh, yes,
Neil,
of course.
Hamilton, probably.
Yeah, the Tory MP. But Jonathan Aiken was a very interesting case, wasn't it?
It was.
I mean, again, cross-examination proved crucial. Aiken more or less broke down in the witness box and
only when
contradicted himself. Only when
confronted with incontrovertible truth, or in terms of the airline manifest, which The Guardian researched endlessly and eventually obtained. And it was due to tremendous work done by the journalists, in fact, rather than anything that happened in court.
Really? Okay. Okay, well, do you go back to Mohammed Al-Fayed and Neil Hamilton, who was a Tory MP, who had taken, who denied that he had gone to the Ritz in Paris. Cash for questions, yes. Mm. And Christine Hamilton, wasn't she involved as well? They were husband and wife
she
duo,
was,
I think.
And my father questioned both of them at length. And, of course, Mohammed Al-Fayed gave evidence at length. An interesting case for all sorts of reasons. And since all the protagonists are alive, should reserve my judgment on.
Very good. Okay.
We'll have to get you back sometime.
Very sensible. Dominic, we have a feature in this. This has been absolutely wonderful. We have a feature on this show where we ask our guests to recommend a book or a movie. Now, I was the one who was liaising with you, and I don't know whether I suggested that to you, but on the hoof, do you think you can come up with a book or a movie that has a legal theme? That's all we need, and which you would recommend to people out there.
Well, pretty dated, but there are some very good film noir legal films. Witness of the Prosecution, The Paradine Case, both of which date back to the late 1940s. Those spring to mind. Those are personal. The trouble with most modern films, which are legal in context, they're over-dramatic and more often than not American and, you know, a little bit hyperbolic and so far removed from reality as to be silly, but that's a personal take. In terms of books, obviously there are many good legal biographies, legal memoirs, and it would be invidious to highlight any in particular. But
Well, your own book has been recommended on this show.
That's very kind.
As a fascinating insight into one of the great legal characters and one of the great advocates of our time. Just to turn the question slightly on its head, who would play your father? I know, was it David Suchet played him in some sort of role or whatever?
But
who's the movie star to play your father? He's not really a Tom Cruise, you can't handle the truth type character, is he? Who would play him?
It's a really difficult question, and I can't automatically think of somebody, but somebody's going to fulfill that role, I understand, next year when a dramatisation of the West End is going to appear, of the Ken Dodd case. So somebody's going to play my father during that, and somebody's playing Ken Dodd, which is an equally difficult role to fulfil, so we will see. Well,
we'll have to travel to London for that one, Mark, yeah. I think, definitely. Dominic Carman, thank you so much for coming in and talking
pleasure.
To us, and talking to us about the work you have done in Dublin, which is fascinating to our listeners, and also for telling us about your late father.
Thank you very much, Steve, for having me. It's been a great pleasure, both of you.
The Fifth Court will adjourn until next week.
And that's all from this edition of The Fifth Court. We hope you have enjoyed it. Can we say a huge thank you to our guest, Dominic Carman, who was over here in Ireland to write a legal report and talk to us about the various interactions he had with our leading corporate firms, Mark. But then we ventured into other matters and we asked him about his biography.
You couldn't leave aside the background and pedigree.
Son
there.
Of course, the late George Carman QC, who was involved in all those fascinating cases. And Dominic was very generous. He had attended a lot of them. You actually asked him about that. Yeah. He had attended a lot of cases that his father was when he was addressing the court. And he talked wonderfully about that. Really, really interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that was really, really good. And I enjoyed that. I would also like to say a big thank you to our producer, Conal O'Moroyne, and to our sound engineer here at the Dublin South Podcast Studios. David, doing a brilliant job as always. If you have any comments or on any topics you'd like to discuss with us, and we have started to get a bit more feedback, Mark, we're really reaching out to people.
And we get a lot of recommendations for guests.
Which is really good. And we will act on those. So we're delighted with any communication you want to make to us. So you know how to contact us, but please do. So for me, Peter Leonard.
And myself, Mark Tottenham.
Thank you for listening, and we will see you very soon in the Fifth Court.